Well, Joseph was playing some great 1940s music to set the scene here, and I left that on this recording. If you want to skip ahead past the music, that'll be 6 minutes in. At 8 minutes in, he starts speaking to Dr. Sweeney. At 14 minutes, we start more the background of this story. And at 18 minutes, if you want to go 18 minutes in, you'll get directly to the story as it relates to KFUN.
You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy when skies are gray. You'll never know, dear, how much I love you. Please don't take my sunshine away. The other night, dear, as I lay sleeping, I dreamed I held you in my arms. When I awoke, dear, I was mistaken, and I hung my head and cried. You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy when skies are gray. You'll never know, dear, how much I love you. Please don't take my sunshine away. I'll always love you and make you happy if you will only say the same. But if you leave me to love another, you'll regret it all someday. You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy when skies are gray. You'll never know, dear, how much I love you. Please don't take my sunshine away. You told me once, dear, you really loved me, and no one else, dear, could come between. But now you've left me and love another. You have shattered all my dreams. You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy when skies are gray. You'll never know, dear, how much I love you. Please don't take my sunshine away.
We'll be right back. Well, folks, good morning to you. 9:17 and 42 degrees in the Meadow City, winds at 13 miles an hour. And, folks, I hope you're enjoying the program here today. And, well, I'm really taking you back to the 40s and playing some of the music that you all were hearing, or some of you, hopefully, in the 40s. KFUN, as you know, went on the air on Christmas Day, 1941. So today, I should really have a huge candle or 73 candles here, and I should have a cake here, but I don't. And anyway, but today, KFUN celebrates 73 years of broadcasting. And folks, as I've been mentioning to you for the last week, that today we have a special interview. And I, you know, I've done so many interviews through the years, but this one to me is really, really special. And I invited Jim Turr to the studio today with me because it's because of Jim Turr that we're having this interview with Dr. Michael S. Sweeney. He is the, as I mentioned earlier this morning, before I aired the history show that I compiled and produced, I mentioned that the I am not the author of the information that I use for the history show. It is the ownership of Dr. Michael S. Sweeney, and I gleaned the information from his manuscript, which thankfully he sent to Mr. Dennis Mitchell, gosh, I don't know how many years ago, he can tell us. But anyway, I hope you enjoyed the program. And then now, I, as I say, invited Jim Turr because he is the one that contacted Dr. Michael S. Sweeney for me through the Internet, the wonders of the Internet. And so, Jim, good morning to you and Merry Christmas to you.
Merry Christmas to you, and thank you, Joseph. Yeah. And let me be the first to congratulate you on 75 years.
73.
73. Yeah. I've been listening for many of those 73 years.
Yeah. Well, let's go to the phone right away because we have Dr. Michael S. Sweeney with us, and graciously on a Christmas morning, he has his family there, his son, and he graciously, him and his wife agreed to lend us some of his time. Dr. Michael Sweeney, are you there?
I am, and you can call me Mike.
Okay, Mike, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you, Justin?
Real good. And Jim Turr is with us as well. He's the one that contacted, that found you. I've been trying to find you for about 5-6 years, I guess. And
oh,
Jim, Jim Turr found you like in a day. Great.
I must be better at the internet. It only took me about 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Where are you, Mike?
I'm in Athens, Ohio, and it's a strange 60 degrees today.
Really?
No sunshine.
Oh. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, you know, Michael, first of all, let me say again, Merry Christmas to you and your family. I know you have your son and grandkids there. You have grandkids as well?
I have a grandson, Jack.
Oh, all
he
right.
is 2 years old, so this is a very big Christmas for him.
Yeah. Well,
he got Cars toys like Mater and the Hudson Hornet and all that. He's very excited.
Yeah. Well, you know, to me it's always interesting how important events like take time to happen, and it's, I guess, in timing or the universe plans it. I don't know. But I was aware that you had sent a portion of a manuscript to Dennis Mitchell, who is the former owner of KFUN. And he told me about it many, many times. My wife and I, Loretta, started working here at KFUN in 79. And then, you know, today we own both KFUN and KLVF. But Dennis Mitchell had told me that you had sent him a manuscript of research you had done having to do with World War II, KFUN, and the censorship department. And, of course, I love history, especially when it has to do about Las Vegas and KFUN and the owners or the founders of KFUN, Ernie and Dorothy Thwaites. But Mr. Mitchell could not remember what happened to the manuscript. Well, anyway, when ownership changed hands here, Mr. Mitchell happened to walk in one day, and he found the new owners that he sold to going through files, and just the right moment, he walked into the office when he saw the owner take this pamphlet and throw it in the trash. And Dennis told him, no, 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 no. He says, no, Joseph would love to have that. So he picked your manuscript out of the basket, and he put it in another file there to be saved for the time that I came across it. And so anyway, I don't know if you got to listen this morning, but I aired about an hour show of history, and I compiled a history show with about, 18, 19 vignettes. And it was all gleaned from your manuscript, so I do not take, the credit for that. It goes to you. Thank you for writing your book, Secrets of Victory. How is your
Thank
book
you.
Doing?
It's doing very well. It started off as my dissertation when I got my PhD, and then I turned it into a book.
Yeah.
And it has been adopted by some college classrooms, college history classrooms across the country.
Yeah.
And I always love talking about this subject. It's what got me to be a professor.
Well, I was going to ask you that why did you find this story so interesting, and then about Ernie and Dorothy Thwaites and KFUN, and, you know, as you know, and you tell in your book that in 1941 there was 900 or 901 radio stations in the country, and the only one that was bucking the system and the censorship department was Ernie Thwaites and KFUN.
Yep.
How did you first come across the information?
Well, when I got to Ohio University as a PhD student, I was married, and I'm still married to the same woman.
Yeah.
And I needed to complete my PhD in a short amount of time and get a job, because I was racking up some bills. So I went to my advisor and I said, I need a subject for my dissertation. And he's a historian, and I've always loved history. And he said, no one's ever done a history of the Office of Censorship.
Mm-hmm.
That was the federal office, a civilian office in Washington, D.C., that supervised the American press and radio in World War II to make sure they didn't give any sensitive information to the enemy, the Germans and the Italians and the Japanese. And so I said, hey, that sounds interesting, because I've always loved to read about the history of journalism, and this is a little subset of that. So I got to looking at it and discovered that there had been a memoir written about the Office of Censorship by someone who worked there, but it was right after World War II, and it was incomplete, and it didn't tell a lot of the juicy things. And so as I was reading this memoir, which is called Weapon of Silence by a man named Theodore Koop, K-O-O-P, he said there was only one time that any member of the United States press openly defied the Office of Censorship and said, no, we won't do what you ask us to do. But they wouldn't say who it was. They said it was some radio station in the Southwest. So when I got to the National Archives and was looking through the Office of Censorship's original records, which are there in College Park, Maryland, I said, I got to find out what was this radio station and what was the complaint? How do they butt heads? And so I found out that it was KFUN in Las Vegas, New Mexico, and I dug into it a little more and also read the unpublished memoirs of the director of the Office of Censorship, a man named Byron Price, who had been the head of the Associated Press, the executive editor of the Associated Press, before he became the federal censor, and discovered what it was all about. And it was really a fascinating story, because I found myself sympathizing with both sides. I could see why the Office of Censorship said, please comply, and I could see why Ernie Thwaites at KFUN said no. And I don't know how much you talked about this morning already, but the Office of Censorship was set up right after the attack on Pearl Harbor by President Roosevelt, and he said he wanted to have a journalist ask journalists around the country to not share sensitive information with the enemy. And so he set up the civilian office, and he couldn't impose laws. He couldn't say, no, you can put censors in newsrooms and say, no, you can't print that, or no, you can't broadcast that, because of the First Amendment. So the system was built on trust. It was built on voluntary self-censorship. And the idea was Byron Price would give all these journalists around the country topics that the Nazis would like to have, they'd like to know about, like where is the secret airplane factory and when are the troop ships sailing and all of that. And so please don't write about these subjects, and please don't talk about these subjects on the radio. And what Byron Price did was he put these suggestions for how to censor yourself out in these little bulletins. They're about the shape of a church bulletin, like 5x7 or so. And they went out to journalists all over the country. And most journalists, in fact, almost all journalists said, sure, we don't want to help the enemy. We'll keep this stuff off the air. Well, there was one of these sets of rules for the print press and one of these sets of rules for the radio. And there was a separate set for radio, because radio is more dangerous than printed press.
Uh-huh.
Because if you make a mistake when you print something, you can always, you know, collect the papers and burn them, or you can make sure they don't circulate outside the country or whatever. But if you make a mistake on a live radio broadcast, it's gone.
Yeah.
You can't call it back.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this special set of requests that Byron Price made of radio stations around the country. One of them was no live weather broadcasts. And that was true up until late 1943. That was interesting. You couldn't tune the radio station and get a forecast. because that would help, you know, the enemy along the coast. But another one was he didn't want unscripted. He didn't want what he called ad lib programs to go out over the air, like man in the street interviews,
sure.
unless they were supervised, because he was afraid, gee, some spy could get on, you know, and send a coded message overseas. What he didn't say to the radio stations was he had already heard from the Attorney General that the Attorney General, in his opinion, saw radio as an international means of communication. You know, radio waves don't conveniently stop at the national border. They keep going.
And let me ask you right there, because I need help in pronouncing that Attorney General. Is it Biddle? Is that the way you pronounce his name?
Francis Biddle.
Biddle,
right?
Okay.
So Francis Biddle tells Byron Price, radio is, by my definition, an international means of communication, and when Franklin Roosevelt set up your office, he gave you absolute control over international communication. You can try to supervise this voluntary media in the United States, but if a message goes outside the United States, you, Byron Price, can do whatever you want. And so he essentially said, you can take over radio stations if you want. But Byron Price didn't want to do that. He figured, first of all, that'd make a lot of people in the United States mad.
Yeah.
Secondly, if people knew that their radio stations were controlled by the government, they might not trust what the radio stations had to say about the war. So he never used this ruling. He called it his club in the closet. You know, if I ever need it, I have it, but I'm going to try real hard to get radio stations to comply with my requests.
He was saving it for Ernie Thwaites.
He was saving it for Ernie.
Yeah.
So I need to fast forward. That's all the background. So by 1943, the Office of Censorship was having some trouble with foreign language radio stations. There were dozens of languages on the air, and they were mostly concerned with people broadcasting in German and Italian, because they weren't sure that, you know, all German Americans and all Italian Americans were going to be loyal, that they might try to send secrets overseas. So they had, and they had some problems with German and Italian broadcasters being disloyal. So they came up with this new rule in the Office of Censorship. It's just for foreign language broadcasters. And it went like this. If you have a foreign language program, we want you to transcribe it before it goes on the air. And then we want you to have someone in your newsroom listen to a live program and compare it to the transcript to make sure that somebody speaking in a foreign language doesn't send out some disloyal message. Well, they said this applies to all foreign languages, not just German and Italian. And so, of course, in KFUN, you have a lot of loyal Spanish-speaking listeners. In fact, they had 11 hours of Spanish language programs every week in 1943. And so Ernie Thwaites, what they asked of him was what they asked of everyone else who had a foreign language program, which was, please transcribe it, and then have someone in your newsroom, you know, sit there and listen to the program as it goes out and make sure that they're not slipping anything disloyal or useful to the enemy on that.
And let me jump in here before you continue. I learned from your book that some radio stations announcers were kind of like antagonizing the War Department because they would even play German music and even make some statements in a foreign language. I guess and the censorship department, I learned from your book, would then even go into some stations and say, you need to fire so and so and so and so. You can talk about that later, but continue about Ernie Thwaites.
I have a question too.
Okay,
if I
just
may.
A minute, Mike.
Sure, Jim.
Why would they be concerned about Spanish? That seems a little off base there.
Right, and that's one of the reasons that I you know have some sympathy for Ernie. He says Spanish is not a quote foreign language in New Mexico. It's recognized as an official language in the courts and the legislature, and we have our Spanish speaking citizens are as loyal as anybody else. So we're not talking about Germans and Italians. And it's not really spelled out in the archive, but what I gather is, first of all, there were lots of Axis-leaning people who spoke Spanish in South America and Central America.
Okay, right.
And so, and then that's, and you know, they might be able to help the Nazis. And the other thing that Byron Price said was, I can't really make exceptions here. You know, if I say it's okay for you, but not for you, then we're on a slippery slope. And so he said, I got to treat everybody the same.
Plus 11 hours of broadcasting, that's pretty cumbersome to transcribe.
Oh, absolutely. And that was Ernie's point. He said, I called it a mom and pop station in my book. he had a very small staff. I think it was just him and his wife at first.
And it still is a mom and pop with Loretta and I, Loretta and I and my daughter and my two sons.
And Ernie said, it would be a real burden on me financially to transcribe all these things. And you know, it'd be a burden on my staff to have someone sit there and listen to all this. So when Byron Price said, we want you to do this, he said no. And this was the only time in World War II where the Office of Censorship made a request of a journalist to not do something, and the journalist refused. And so this threw Byron Price into a, you know, he didn't know what to do, because he said, I can't have open defiance down there in New Mexico, because then other people are going to want to, you know, not follow the censorship request. And he didn't know whether to bring out the club in the closet or what. So he had to find a way to figure out how to get Ernie Thwaites and KFUN on board without, you know, without going overboard and squashing, you know, this radio station in New Mexico.
Yeah, that's interesting. Mike, have you one question that I have is: have you found or have you been able to track in the National Archives? Because eventually Ernie Thwaites did comply after going off the air, I think, for about 7-8 months in Spanish broadcasting.
Spanish, right. He brought it back. But yeah. And he was pressured to do that, I think.
Yeah, yeah. But he did eventually even send in tape recordings, right, of their newscasts. Do you think the National Archives still has those tapes? I would love to have a tape or tapes of Spanish news broadcasts from 41, 42, 43, that Ernie Thwaites broadcast. Is that an impossibility, or have you tried to find those tapes?
I think that's a long shot.
Yeah.
I found in the National Archives, in the Office of Censorship Records, which is Record Group 216, is occasional transcripts, so the printed word of what people said. And they would ask for foreign language broadcasts from foreign language stations on a sort of random basis, just to make sure that they were complying with the code.
Yeah.
But those did not go to the Office of Censorship because it had a really small staff. They went to the Foreign Broadcast Intelligence Service, the FBIS.
Oh, yeah.
And I have not checked there. That might be the place to see if they have an archive of those broadcasts from the war.
And I'm sorry, what? That was foreign what?
It's FBIS. I think it's Foreign Broadcast Intelligence Service.
I'm
going to look it up in my book here.
Okay.
And if I got it wrong, I can always email you.
Okay, great. Okay. Now, continue with your story.
Oh, well, so what happened was Byron Price sent a representative from the broadcasting division of his Office of Censorship to a lot of stations in the Southwest, because it wasn't just KFUN. There were a lot of other stations at first that said, we don't want see the reason we need to do this, to have this these transcripts and these people checking them. And everyone complied except KFUN. And so when Byron Price's representative, a man named Edward Bronson, got there, they had this conversation. And Bronson eventually, you know, convinced him, hey, you need to either put these transcripts out and check them, or you got to shut down Spanish language broadcasting. And I think in those conversations that Bronson laid out the fact that Byron Price had this club in the closet, the Attorney General's ruling that he could shut down any radio station if it didn't comply with the code. But I don't have proof of that. But I think that, you know, Bronson said, you got to do this or we'll close you down.
Yeah.
So what Ernie Thwaites did was he shut down, as you say, Spanish language broadcasting for a while. But as I say in the book, he conceded the battle but not the war.
Yeah.
So what he does is he starts complaining about how these federal bureaucrats in Washington have stopped Spanish language broadcasting at KFUN. And he gets the governor of the state and he gets his congressman to call up Byron Price and say, hey, what's going on? You know, our Spanish-speaking listeners are as loyal and patriotic as anybody else. Why can't we have Spanish language? And they're essentially lobbying to have KFUN bring Spanish language back, but without the controls. So Byron Price finally sends a representative from the National Association of Broadcasters to talk with Ernie Thwaites, and in my book I talk about Price trying to flip the narrative, and the NAB representative says to Thwaites, you can have Spanish language anytime you want, and we would certainly like to have you get it back on the air. And please tell us when you're willing to comply with our code of wartime practices and put that that sensor in your office so you can, you know, check your broadcast. Please tell us when you'll have Spanish back on the air. In other words, it's up to you,
yeah,
not us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's when Ernie raised the white flag and said, okay. Now, for the rest of the war, he was just as good as anybody else. But for 4 months, he was the only one who said, no, we're not gonna comply with these. And I say in my book, I have a lot of sympathy for him. He was, yeah, a small little operation. It was a big burden on him. And who could argue that this, you know, I don't know how many watts it was, 250, I think.
Yeah.
This little radio station in New Mexico was going to be, you know, the problem that causes us to lose the war, right? It's a long shot. It's far-fetched.
Mike, let me interject here. You mentioned a flag, and I've mentioned this in my talk show. In fact, I talked about our interview for the last week. Can you make mention and how you feel about the statement that Bronson made when he made his rounds through the radio stations around the country? He said that he believed that now we could raise, and can you know what I'm saying? You know what I'm,
yeah, he says, now we can raise the white flag of purity.
Yeah, wow, that's like a, how do you take that statement? I don't know how to take that statement. How do you interpret that?
I think he was being hyperbolic. What he's saying is, we have 100% compliance.
Yeah.
And by that he meant that whenever the Office of Censorship asked a journalist to do something, that they said okay. And that's what I found in my research, mm-hmm, throughout World War II. It was such a case where the journalists who covered the war abroad and at home were every bit as patriotic as every other citizen. They wanted to do their part, and so they wanted to comply with these requests. I mean, they didn't want to put out any news that could be used against the American armed forces.
Uh-huh.
So what I argue in the book is, you know, the reason the censorship regulation, this voluntary self-censorship system, worked so well was there's patriotism. It was the good war. And secondly, can you imagine what would happen if someone actually violated these requests and something bad happened?
Sure.
You would lose advertisers. You would lose audience. There's an economic disincentive to violating the censorship code.
Especially because if something bad happened, think of the families that have lost loved ones and would lose a lot of more loved ones. If that information, let's say through KFUN, would have gotten out to the enemy, well, all the listeners would have blamed Ernie Thwaites, you know, and then you bring in the emotion factor into it of losing a loved one, and they'd say KFUN disclosed this information to the enemy or whatever.
Yeah.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, and like I say, it's not likely that KFUN would do that, but
no.
In my book I talk about some other radio broadcasters who had real secrets, and of course Drew Pearson was one of them.
Well, you also mentioned in your book, which I thought was interesting, that a lot of stations on the coast, state of Washington, San Francisco, they willingly went off the air, right?
Some stations did.
Yeah.
Japanese language stations went off the air.
Yeah.
Some stations cut back, and then right after the attack on Pearl Harbor along the West Coast, California, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, stations went black.
Yeah.
Because they thought that was the best thing to do to keep information from the enemy,
sure,
to keep panic from spreading and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
How about German stations on the East Coast? There must have been a few of those, right?
Yes. There are huge German-speaking populations in Philadelphia, New York, Boston, Milwaukee. And Byron Price was urged by some in the army to shut them down.
Yeah.
And he said, no, we need to get information to loyal German-speaking Americans and Italian-speaking Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And so these were really the stations that he was targeting with these foreign language radio station requests to monitor and have transcripts and all that. And in fact, he had there was a big conference in Washington. What should we do when we find someone who's being disloyal? And the Attorney General said it's up to Byron Price, among all the people in Washington, to figure out who's disloyal and to remove them. And he did remove one German American from a radio station and one Italian American from a radio station because their sympathies were apparently with the Axis. But like I say, he never found anyone at a Spanish-speaking station or other station that he was afraid would give too much information to the enemy.
And you know, in 41, you know, in fact, Mike, I know you're aware of this. Today we're celebrating KFUN's 73 years of broadcasting.
I heard that. I didn't know you opened on Christmas Day. That's
Christmas
very cool.
Day, 1941. Yeah, 19 days after Pearl Harbor. And in those days, in 41, you know, KFUN is the sixth oldest station in New Mexico. So in that year, KFUN was the only radio station in the northeast part of New Mexico. Of course, in Albuquerque, we had the number one station, KOBAM. But anyway, so I, you know, and that's why I chose today to air the history show that I put together. And I'll be glad to furnish you a copy of the show. But I also chose today for this interview, and thank you and your wife and your family for allowing us to interrupt your Christmas morning family time.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
You know, this to us is really, really wonderful because it's so important history of Las Vegas and of KFUN and Ernie and Dorothy Thwaites and World War II and all those events. I mean, we have some survivors still living in Las Vegas that were prisoners and marched that Bataan Death March.
Oh my goodness.
Oh yeah, In fact,
we salute them.
Well, yes. And you know, my son came across about, I don't know, a year or two ago. He came across some old newspapers of our local newspaper, The Optic. And so I have about four copies of newspapers going back to 41, 42, and 43. And the front pages of all those, it's all about World War II, Hitler, and all, what was going on. You know, so that whole thing fits in really nicely. Have you been invited to speak at colleges and talk about your book and about this experience?
Yes, I've been. I've spoken many times about this.
Yeah.
I always enjoy the opportunity to talk about my research on World War II censorship, and then I've done some other books of history about wartime censorship.
Well, you know, your book really ties in with a lot of our history because you mentioned also, you know, Theodore Roosevelt and the Rough Riders. You know, the Rough Riders, well, President Theodore Roosevelt, we have photos and documentation of him and the Rough Riders being in Las Vegas, and the Rough Riders chose Las Vegas as their hometown. Every year they would have a reunion here in Las Vegas. So that is, I say, very important history for our community. And Jim has a question, but first I want to ask you so I don't forget if you ever contacted any of the other radio stations that you mentioned in your book. But let's get to Jim, and then we'll get to that question later. Jim, go ahead.
Well, two things. I do have a small technical question. Now, KOB, which Joseph mentioned in Albuquerque, is 50,000 watts, used to be anyway. KFUN was 250 watts. Now, as a practical matter, couldn't they have excluded stations, you know, under a certain wattage, a certain distance from the border, or they just didn't want to make exceptions at all, because I'm sure KFUN's signal doesn't go outside this county, probably.
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and people talked about that at length. And they decided that there'd have to be one rule for all, and the reason for that was that under certain atmospheric conditions, a radio station with a weak signal can bounce around the globe.
And that's true, Mike. You know, I've received emails and also letters from people that, you know, one time someone sent me an email telling me, I picked up KFUN in Canada. So you're right.
Yep.
Because of the atmospheric conditions, that can happen.
So the Office of Censorship thought that there would be greater compliance if there was one rule for all, if they didn't start making exceptions. And they were afraid if they started doing that, then everyone would want one.
Yeah.
I just wanted to mention, if this isn't letting the cat out of the bag, that I've been talking for a long time and thinking about this and running it by people, and now I've talked to you about it, Mike, and I want to talk more about, I think this story has all the makings of a really hit documentary or maybe a hit movie if slightly fictionalized, and I've got a long list of people in the media and the business I'd like to send it to, you know, if we come up with an idea for how to propose this as a movie or something. So I'm very excited to move forward with that.
Well, I thought it was a kind of a David and Goliath story. You know, you got this big federal bureaucracy in Washington, D.C., and you have this two-person operation out in New Mexico. And as I said when we started talking, I said, I love this story because I have great sympathy for both sides. There's, you know, you could argue either side with pretty good conviction, I think.
I appreciate
that.
And
those are the kinds of stories that I think people get into.
Yeah, I appreciate that view on it. I wish more people appreciated that about almost every controversy, by the way.
Mike, so with what's going on now the wars and terrorism and all that is more terrible today, more threatening. Is the censorship doing any of this today? And how come they're not?
We haven't had any kind of government-directed censorship of the media, at least in this country, since World War II.
And that's why it makes this story so amazing.
Yeah, and I don't know whether it'd even be possible to have an effective censorship today, because with electronic communication, digital communication, everyone is potentially a journalist.
Yeah. So are you open to Jim's suggestion about having this become a movie or a documentary?
Sure. I've played around with screenplays. I mean, who hasn't?
They're fun. Yeah. And so... moving forward, I know that you wrote a letter to Dennis Mitchell, which I still have, by the way, and I treasure that letter. And through that letter, I called the phone number that you supplied there, and I couldn't get, you know, all I got was, you know, number discontinued or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know if you have moved out of the country or whatever, you know. But I still have the manuscript and that letter, and I treasure that, you know.
Letter talking about this episode.
About this whole thing, yes, yes. And I just recently acquired your book, Secrets of Victory. And I really, you know, people that are interested in this, I really encourage them to check it out and possibly buy your book, you know, because it has so much valuable information in there.
Maybe our local bookstore, Tome on the Range.
Oh, yeah, they can get it. Yeah, they can get it, yeah.
When was it published, Mike, the book?
2001.
It came out in 2001.
Wow.
It took me 3 years to write it, and it took me 4 years to get it published, which is about par for the course, I think.
And it 13 years to get it publicized here.
Yeah.
And what comments have you gotten either from the publisher or from the public in general about your book? Because it's one of a kind. Nobody's ever talked about this, as you said.
Yes. Well, there's a group of people called the American Journalism Historians Association, or AJHA, and they're people who teach media history and research media history, and they named it their book of the year, their very first book of the year when it came out.
Wow.
And then I have to tell you this story. It's just a short one, I promise.
No, that's all right.
When this book came out in 2001, and it's responsible for all the good things in my life since then, I was sitting in my, I got a job as a professor right after I finished writing this book, and I was in my office. This is at Utah State University in Logan. That's why you couldn't reach me in Ohio, because I changed state.
Okay. All right.
And the phone rang, and it was a literary agent from New York, and he said he was looking for someone to write a book. This is right after 9/11, and he said, I have a large publishing company that is interested in putting out a book about how Americans learn about war through war correspondence.
Uh-huh.
And we'd like to know if you'd like to do it. And he said he found out about me through some of his contacts, and I thought I might be able to do it. And did I have anything that he could read that, you know, he could judge whether I could write this book or not? And I said, yeah, I've got this book called Secrets of Victory, and there's part of it online.
Uh-huh.
Well, he looked it up online, he read some of it, and he said, I want you to write this book about how we learn about war. And it's at that point, he said, and the publisher is the National Geographic, and we're going to pay you this huge salary. And I went, oh, thank you. Led to a nice chain of other publications and enough money to get me out of my student loans and and other things.
Well, that's great.
So it's been very, very good to me.
That's great. Jim?
So to show your debt of gratitude to Las Vegas, have you ever visited us here?
I have not. I love northern New Mexico. I have been to Albuquerque and Santa Fe.
Well, this is even nicer. I think you need to come. We need to have an event, a book signing, and honor you here.
That's a good idea, Jim.
Publicized by Joseph and KFUN.
You know, that's a good idea, Mike, and I'm sure that our local bookstore would be willing to host you, and maybe our university, and we could have you do a talk, you know, at our university here.
But, well, let's try to set that up. That'd be great.
Oh, yeah. I think that's a great idea. Well, you know, I've got, let's see, 10 o'clock news coming up in about 8 minutes or so, and I don't want to take time from this valuable interview. So you knew how Ernie Thwaites, how his story ended, right, that he died in a plane crash in 1962?
I think Dennis Mitchell told me that.
Yeah,
right?
He did, yeah, yeah. And in fact, the censorship department, I don't know who, but somebody contacted Mr. Dennis Mitchell, and he's the one that told them, well, Mr. Thwaites died in a plane crash. And so anyway, yeah.
So they were still hassling him decades later.
Yeah, they were still. Why would they continue that questioning so long?
Well, it wasn't the Office of Censorship. I don't know who it was. Yeah. The Office of Censorship closed down right after VJ Day.
Oh.
I mean, their whole purpose was to keep information from the enemy, and we didn't have any enemy anymore. They shut down.
Yeah, I see. Okay.
So somebody else, maybe another historian from the federal government, something like that. Don't know.
You know, the other thing that I really appreciate of your book is, because I have read your manuscript I don't know how many times. I mean, I've read it and read it and gone through it, because I find that so valuable, the history of KFU and this whole thing so interesting. And so, but so what I appreciate in your book is that finally, on certain pages, I was able to see a photo of Mr. Price, and I said, oh, that's him. It kind of just added to my memory of who this guy was and helped me to connect, and Bronson as well, you know. You have a photo where Herbert Hoover is leaning over a table talking to Price and someone else. And I thought,
wow. Oh, J. Edgar Hoover. Right?
Yeah, J. Edgar Hoover. And that really helped, in my mind, to connect those things. So did you have to get permission from someone to publish those photos in your book?
Yes. Well, for some. If the photographs were taken by the U.S. government, they are copyright free. The people of the United States own them, so those are free. But there are some others, like that there's a cartoon of Byron Price talking about the weather.
Yeah.
I had to pay for those.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Wow. Oh, I don't know if I asked you, I brought up the question earlier. Have you thought of contacting any of the other radio stations that you mentioned in your book? Because I have. I just haven't had the time to hunt them down. Because do other radio stations, whoever owns them now, know the history of this whole thing and how their station played a part in it?
I don't think they do.
Yeah.
How many people have ever heard of the Office of Censorship before this radio broadcast?
No.
Probably not many.
No.
The only ones that I investigated were people whose names kept coming up in the Office of Censorship archives.
Yeah.
So I mentioned Drew Pearson before. He had he was a nationally syndicated radio, a news analyst, and an investigative reporter. And so he's in the Office of Censorship Archives because he knew lots of secrets, and they were worried he's going to spill them. This is the kind of guy that the Office of Censorship really should have been worried about, right? He knew about the atomic bomb. He knew what was going on in Los Alamos.
Yeah.
He knew what was going on in Oak Ridge.
Yeah.
And he kept that. You know, they looked at his broadcasts and they looked at the transcripts every week to make sure he didn't let that secret out, and he did not.
Yeah,
He knew about the bomb for a year and a half before Hiroshima.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. I'm trying to think here real quickly because we're running out of time of what question I haven't asked you. But, Jim, do you have a question or something that you haven't asked that I've missed? Or?
I had one, but I forgot it. But among the many things I thought were interesting this morning was to hear that they censored the weather reports. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how this might relate, but I actually lead or have led a spy tour of Santa Fe that I put together about how Santa Fe relates to many of the spy secrets getting out relating to Los Alamos.
Yeah, you mentioned...
I'm blanking. I know exactly you're
talking
about.
Somebody from New Mexico?
Yeah, Jim. You told me you're trying to set up an interview with her for me.
Oh, Valerie Plame.
Plame, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the one, the spy who is out. I don't know if that's who you were thinking of, Mike, but Valerie Plame, who is outed as a spy by the Bush administration.
Yeah.
Right. I didn't know she's from New Mexico.
Well, they've lived in New Mexico several years now, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Well, Mike, we're running out of time, but again, I want to revisit the suggestion that Jim had. Do you think that's a possibility that, you know, in 2015 we can arrange and, you know, we can certainly talk to our university and see if they would host you to come and talk about your books and about this part of the history and get our local bookstore involved and have you here in Las Vegas?
Well, I would love to. I got to have the proviso that if my health holds up, I've had some health issues. But
really?
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of fun.
You sound very vital. I hope you stay that way.
Me too. It helps having family at Christmas, I'll tell you that.
Well,
it gets your energy
done.
Level
yeah,
up.
Yeah. I'm curious, a very personal question. I'm just wondering, you don't have to answer it. How old are you?
I'm 56.
Oh, all right. Okay, I'm a lot older than you are. I'm 68.
we also have a wonderful college called the United World College here,
yeah,
with a wonderful, bright bunch of students who'd probably love to hear this history, too.
From throughout the world.
Yeah.
The only one in the whole United States is 4 miles. They're in our backyard. A wonderful gem in our community, and I'm sure they would probably love to hear you. Well, you know, Jim, I hope we can follow through on this. Let's stay in contact, and we have our emails, and I would love to meet you one of these days, and maybe we can get a local business here to partially financially sponsor this and so forth. So I'll work on that too. So
wishing you good health, Michael.
And
thanks so much.
So yeah, Mike. I've been playing music from the 40s this morning to set people's minds at with what was going on in the 40s with KFUN music, tying in with this history show. I'll send you a copy of the history show that I did off your manuscript, just so you can have it. And of course, Jim is recording this interview as well. We'll provide you a copy of that as well, Mike.
Thank you so much, Joseph.
Mike, I really thank you and your family. Give your regards to your wife and your family for us, and say thank you to your wife for allowing us to interrupt your morning Christmas family visit. Thank you so much, Mike.
You're most welcome.
Take care.
Merry Christmas.
Bye-bye. Adios.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Jim, too.
Thank you for including me, Joe.
Sure. We're going to listen to a little bit of this music, folks, and thank you, Jim, for setting up. You're the guy that made this possible, this interview, because you're the one that contacted Mike Sweeney for me, so thank you.
You're
Jim.
Welcome for my 30 seconds of effort, Joseph.
All right. And this is KFUN AM 1230 and KFUN FM 103.7 in the original Las Vegas, New Mexico. We now join our news. Bye-bye. Have a great Christmas. Bye-bye.
AP Radio News. I'm Tim McGuire. Amid all the Christmas celebration, a somber Pope Francis in his Christmas message to